This week, the precious metals rally continued for the third week running, with silver stealing the show, adding over half a dollar at $18.26, while U.S. equities posted an impressive rebound rally. Welcome, everyone. Your host, Chris Waltzek. It's just a pleasure to be back with you with Dos Muy Grande-sized guest interviews. Silver is one of the top-performing asset classes of 2017. In just 3 months, the precious metal has picked up 14%, a remarkable rally. Gold not far behind with an 8% gain, according to my guest, the silver investor David Morgan. The nascent silver bull market is alive and well. He outlines his proprietary silver ratio analysis and suggests higher prices are here to stay. Then a modern Jesse Livermore, Martin Armstrong of Armstrong Economics, and the hit documentary film The Forecaster returns to the show. He advises gold investors to ignore all of the inflation deflation rhetoric, focusing instead on the yellow metal as a hedge against policymakers around the globe. He shares a quote by Milton Friedman: if you put economic policymakers in charge of the Sahara, there would be a shortage of sand in just 3 years. He's looking for a currency collapse in the coming years, but expects the Dow Industrials to double, maybe climbing as high as 40,000, and for gold to climb along with it before the crash. And Robert Ian wraps up the show with his must-hear report. Remember, we'd like to field your questions and comments. We should be back at the phone lines next week. That's 641-715-3900, and you'll need our extension 514049. Please jot this down on a Post-it pad or program it right into the phone. GoldSeek.com radio begins now with the market weather recap. Visibility virtually unlimited over the precious metals market for the third week running, as investors preferred the safe haven amid stronger than expected inflation numbers. Gold shrugged off the U.S. dollar rally, adding $2.70, while silver picked up nearly 3%, finishing at $18.26 an ounce. The precious metals XAU shares were off just fractionally, ending below 84. Black gold, though, picked up 260, perking up strongly 5.5%, finishing at 50.60 per barrel. The top story driving the markets this week: investors turn to the precious metals yet again as the hedge of choice amid political uncertainty in the EU as well as in the U.S. Plus, the Lunar New Year demand from China helped gold record one of the strongest first quarters in years. Gold has registered positive gains in 8 of the last 10 years' first quarters. The Shanghai premium above the London spot price remains at around $12 per ounce. In related news, domestic inflation continues to increase at the biggest clip in nearly 5 years, further increasing demand for gold. Investors are discounting the threat of future Fed rate hikes with the strong GDP, inflation, and unemployment numbers, plus increased demand from India, where consumers are still recovering from the shock of the new digital currency, which stymied almost all precious metals demand from the billion-person nation. Elsewhere, Dallas Fed President Rob Kaplan told Market Watch that one of the biggest factors facing the economy remains uncertainty over the fiscal plans and tax stimulus and related policy changes, that this could slow consumer spending. And we're certainly seeing signs of that with what some pundits are referring to as the retail apocalypse. Sears, Macy's, and many other large retailers such as Radio Shack are shutting down hundreds of stores or just going out of business altogether, laying off thousands, unfortunately, in an already difficult job market. Cleveland Fed President Loretta Mester is expecting, however, strong GDP growth above 2% in 2017 and sees a sustained return of 2% inflation, another big positive for the yellow metal, precious metals, bottom line. The technical outlook for gold and silver improved yet again for the third week. In particular, obviously, silver, which blasted through huge support, closing at the highs of the week. It's now at a major juncture, a golden cross in the weekly chart where the 50-period moving average is trying to move over the 200. This could imply a retest of the $21 zenith that we saw last year. However, gold in the XAU lost just a little bit of momentum amid dollar strength. So I would expect a consolidation in the coming weeks before the next big push higher. Moving on to the Wall Street report, sunny skies returned over the New York Stock Exchange as investors cheered better than expected jobs and GDP numbers. By Friday's close, the Dow Industrials was up about 67 points, ending at 26.63. The S&P added 20, finishing at 23.62, while the NASDAQ picked up 83, closing at 59.11, an all-new record weekly close. And, of course, Bitcoin, the ETF GBTC, picked up 7 points, finishing at 116. Meanwhile, the big news pushing U.S. equities higher this week was clearly the monthly non-farms payroll report, which indicated an increase of about 235,000 new jobs in February. That was 30,000 more than expected by analysts. The national unemployment rate also dropped from 4.8% down to 4.7%, well within the full employment 5% target rate. The news helped move the U.S. equities even higher on Thursday, with the financial shares and tech shares leading the rally. Big GDP numbers make financial companies very happy. The GDP expanded at around 2% in the fourth quarter, topping the 1.9% rate, while the jobless number declined, dropped marginally from the previous week's report. Regional banks in particular rallied, including Zions Bank Corp, Z-I-O-N, which added 2.6%, Regions Financial, RF, and the Spiders S&P Regional Banking ETF picked up 3%. Bottom line on equities. Well, the Greed and Fear Index bounced into neutral territory this week. So the floor that I suggested in the last report may already be in place. For the time being, investors clearly like the GDP and employment numbers. The economy seems to be firing on all 8 cylinders, and investors are looking forward to corporate tax revisions that might just spur economic output. Coming up after the break, more GoldSeek.com radio. We'd like for you to stay with us. Martin Armstrong, author of The Greatest Bull Market in History, Economic Confidence Model, and founder of Princeton Economics, plus the Forecaster movie that we've all enjoyed. Welcome back, Martin Armstrong.
Thank you for inviting me.
First of all, this Trump rally, they're calling it, it's been suffering in the last week or so, one of the sharpest declines since the 70s. What's going on in your perspective?
Effectively, it's part of it, yes, you know, the press is very domestic-oriented. So they're attributing it to Trump. I would say half of it is definitely because of his policies, lower the tax rate, et cetera. I mean, then this is really what's necessary to get the economy going. Even Keynes had said that a long time ago. He said that there's sometimes lowering interest rates work, but you also should lower the tax rate. And of course, politicians, they don't do that. I mean, that's part of the problem in Europe. They've taken interest rates to negative, but they've been raising the taxation rate. The bottom line is, how much money are you left with in your pocket? You know, and they don't get that. It's they think lowering interest rates will stimulate the economy, and it doesn't work that way. If you think the stock market will go up 20%, you'll gladly pay 10% interest. But if you don't think it's going to go up even 5%, you're not going to pay 5. So it's not the empirical level of interest rates. It's really against, it has to be measured against the expectation. And that's really the critical issue. As long as you expect things to rise, then the level of interest rates will have no impact on it. The interest rates rose really from 76 all the way up into 1981. And when Volcker raised interest rates dramatically, but we didn't see the stock market crash by 90%. So it really has nothing to do with that. The Trump rally, as they're calling it, has another facet to it. And what's happening is that capital is running away from government. And the numbers, you know, came out for Eurostat, which showed this was the first time, 2016, when there were net sellers of government debt in Europe. So you have also at the same time, as there was almost $200 billion in liquidation of government debt, a lot of it went back up to almost, you know, $50 billion went back into equities in Europe. So people are realizing that you're better off because all these governments are simply broke. you have everyone trying to come up with some, you know, scheme to figure out some new sort of taxation. And it's just, you know, all they ever do is they just raise taxes. We have people that run in government. Honestly, it would be like me trying to write a book on how does it feel to give birth. The problem is, and I've worked with governments around the world from China to the Middle East, and politicians are all the same. And you'll never find any of them, they just, you know, sit there and waddle in their own power. And they think they can pass a law and that law will make everything change.
Exactly.
And it does not, okay? And, I mean, fine, they've outlawed prostitution. Have they ended it? No. They've outlawed, you know, sports gambling. Have they ended it? No. They've outlawed drugs. The war of drugs. I mean, you can't write a law to eliminate anything. It's just not going to work. You know, in the Great Depression, as soon as you do that, what happens is you create a black market. That's what made the mafia. They would never have made a lot of money if it wasn't for prohibition. You're making it tax-free. It's just really absurd. But government is just incapable of doing anything. And honestly, my view is this. They will not do anything at all on a preventative measure. Politician stands up and says, vote for me because I saved your job. You're going to say, well, gee, how do I know I would have lost it? And they would rather you lose your job and then say, vote for me, I'll get the guy that did, around the world. You cannot walk into there and say, if you don't do this, this is going to happen. And it's not going to work. I mean, I walked into the U.S. Treasury back in the early 80s when Volcker was raising interest rates. I said, guys, what are you, absolutely crazy here? You're raising interest rates to stop inflation, but you're the biggest borrower. I said, the national debt's going to, you know, basically triple by the end of the decade simply because of what you're paying now. And they just looked at me and they just said, well, yeah, but we'd be paying back with cheaper dollars. And so you walk out and say, okay, fine, you know, just go blow up the world. You know what you want me to tell you? It's, I went into Switzerland when they did it was called in there, they set up the peg with the euro. I looked at them, I said, you know, nobody has ever succeeded in doing what you're attempting to do. Oh yeah, but we think we can. I said, all right, fine, it's just going to blow up. The peg then blows up. I was named like forecaster of the year for that. And like, come on, really? You know? And I just looked at him and I said, you know, I think the odds are in my favor. If not one single person has ever succeeded, how am I going to be wrong? I think what it really is this, is that if you work for any of the institutions, a bank, whatever, you have to sign a confidentiality. You can be a great analyst, and let's say you're at Citibank, and you came out and say, well, you know, the euro is going to crash. How is the press going to report that? They're going to say Citibank justice. They're not going to attribute it to you personally. You can't say things, and you have to sign these confidentiality agreements. So I get emails from guys in the industry all the time. They go, oh, I really wish I could say what you do. It's because they're restrained. They can't say it. We're independent, so we can say what I've got the same experience that they do. It's not that they don't necessarily see it. I tell them all the time, if you wanted to create the euro, bring in the guys from the trading desk. We'll all sit there and tell you how this works. They don't bring in anybody that has experience. I testified before Congress, and I was the only guy with experience. I told them, make sure I'm last. I was before the House Ways and Means Committee, and they apologized to me. Well, gee, you know, we don't have anybody else to put on the panel besides you, so we're going to have to fill it with a couple of economists. You know, I said, yeah, all right, fine, go ahead. They then say, oh, gee, what do you think if we change the tax rate in the United States? What would happen to the dollar? All of them said, well, in theory, it shouldn't really change. And they get to me, well, look, you know, you change the tax rate, the dollar will go up about 25%. And they all get mad because they're just, it's like I said, they've never done anything. But like I said, you know, how can I write a book on what it feels like to give, you know, childbirth?
Tell us about this concept of debt and the damage it can do on the economy. You were talking about the 70s. Well, fast forward to today, we're approaching $20 trillion Medicaid, Medicare. According to some of our guests here, $200 trillion plus. What might that mean for the markets?
That's why the stock market's been going up. Honestly, you're probably going to see the Dow hit closer to 40,000 than you would see it go back to 1,000. Mainly because, you know, where smart money ends up going. And most of the analysts that talk P.E. ratios and stuff like this, forget it. They're clueless. You look at the P.E. ratio. What is the historical high? It's about 120. And when did it take place? At the 2009 low. Why? Because if you're worried about the banks, you're going to fail. You don't know what governments are going to survive. Where do you put your money? Okay? You put it in equities. They all bought blue chips. And at that point, you're parking money. I don't care about, you know, what revenues they're going to make. I don't care about, you know, if they're going to get 6% dividends. All I want to know is, am I going to get my money back? When you get to those critical points, it's not about investing. It's about parking. That's where we're at. This is why whatever you see in the Dow, charted in different currencies, charted in euro and other, and you'll see that the more the dollar goes up, they make more money than we do. This is why the Japan bubble took place, okay? The Japanese yen was going up and the Nikkei. So a foreigner made an extra 20%. So it's always the wild card coming in from the outside that does this. So it's not the, you know, the domestic side. I mean, it's, you know, domestically people, you know, keep calling for the crash, et cetera. Why? Oh, because it's at record highs and P.E. ratios.
You know, all we've heard since 2009 is this is the top, this is the peak, watch out below, buy bear funds now. From every pundit, especially in the blogosphere, they have been perpetually wrong, but this thing has got more legs than we thought. Why are we going to fight the bull market?
No, it's very simple. I mean, I think Barron's actually did a piece on me, I think it was back in 2011, and I think it was more tongue-in-cheek, because we said, look, stock market's going to continue to make new highs. So they put an article, so yeah, Armstrong saying the stock market's going to make new highs. And I think it was kind of like, they talked to, you know, 30 analysts, and they're all bearish. I can tell you, I was called in to the Brady Commission in 1987, you know, crashed. I didn't want to go in because I felt largely dealing with academics and politicians, and they kept lobbying a bunch of friends of mine to get me to go in, and they were pulling on my heartstrings, basically saying that if I didn't go in, they were going to blame all the computers. I went in, and it was like, I think it was, his name was Professor Gottlieb from Harvard or wherever it was. He's put in charge of investigation. Immediately said, we're going to find out who shorted this market and forced it down, blah, blah, blah. You realize that every investigation since 1907 has begun with us, never found anything. And he's just looking at me. I said, and he said, well, what made it go down? I said, very simple. I said, you know, the view is, again, someone who had no experience. And he says, okay, fine. I said, your theory of this huge short, I said, how is it going to happen? Futures, every trade has got to be matched. In equities, if I'm going to short the equity, I'm borrowing the equity from this guy, so he's still long. Now I sell it, and I just created another long. So how is somebody going to outnumber the long? And he's just looking at me, and he's, what makes it go down? I said, very simple. Everybody's long. Something scares them. They turn around. They try to sell. And nobody's willing to buy, to catch a falling knife. There's no bid. Now you get the flash crash. And he's just looking at me. I said, that's why you'll never find a huge short position. I said, and never outlaw them, because it's the short guys.
You've got it. They provide the liquidity when everybody else is selling and is tossed in the towel.
That's why the stock market keeps going up. You have so many people bear it. What happens is they keep trying to sell every little high, and they stop out.
Exactly. Remember, he said the most expensive trade in any market is that high. Trying to catch that high and trying to catch the low, it bankrupts more people. And they have been calling the top in this market for at least 5 straight years. The trend is up. They're just fighting the natural momentum.
I would say the primary difference between us and them is that we're international. I mean, I've got offices in Abu Dhabi to Beijing. We have to deal with people around the world. And the difference is that everybody acts, just like Adam Smith, out of their own self-interest. So if the dollar is going up, they're making money if the stock market still prints the same price today as it did yesterday. They made money on the currency. So a lot of people don't necessarily understand currency in a lot of this stuff.
You know, that's a great segue, Martin Armstrong, into question for you with regard to just how much of this U.S. equities phenomenon is tied directly to capital fleeing from the EU, from the Eurozone, as well as China and related Asian nations. We've got a lot of political instability. We have negative interest rates like we've never seen right now, the People's Bank of China.
Most of it is. Like, for example, Trump is wrong in blaming China or all their currency manipulators to get trade. China was going after, you know, Bitcoin because the bulk of money flowing through Bitcoin is from China. And they were using it as a means to get it out of China.
Exactly, because they're putting capital constraints right now on almost all the top money managers in China. And they're fleeing.
It's absolutely different. I mean, you take the... All right, a lot of people were saying, oh, gold's going to go up because it's hyper, you know, the Fed is monetizing. Take a look at the real numbers. They go, oh, the Fed, you know, and created, you know, like, you know, $3 trillion. All right, fine. But the Fed is then going to start buying in the bonds. The bankers then say, well, where are we going to put our money? So the Fed then creates excess reserve. It ends up being almost like, you know, $3 trillion now. Okay, so why wasn't this not inflationary? Okay, I'm buying the bonds. Here's the cash for the bond. Okay, fine. I'm going to give it back to you and put it in the excess reserve, and you pay me 0.5% interest. Oh, okay. How did this stimulate anything? It didn't go into the pockets of the consumer. Then, to make it even more complicated, you then have Europe over there trying to, you know, the ECB going negative. I can tell you, they're my clients. All the European banks, they opened up U.S. branches. They then ship the money to their U.S. branch. The U.S. branch parks it at the Fed. Negative interest rates over there by the ECB. So you have, you know, Draghi over there with negative interest rates, desperately trying to stimulate the economy since 2008. Okay, 8 years and it has not worked. Don't you think at some point you're going to think, maybe I should try something different? These people are drunk with their own power. They think that they can simply write a law and make everything happen, and it does not work.
You know, the greenback had a remarkable rally for about a year and a half, basically going sideways. Will the gold bulls be vindicated? Will the dollar eventually roll over and continue in its downtrend?
The dollar has backed off. You've had a rally in the euro, et cetera. Why? Because particularly after March 15th, when the current prime minister won in Netherlands, the pessimistic view that Europe was falling apart backed off a little bit, and now you have the French elections coming up. That's going into May 7th. Now, these things are important because, you know, if Le Pen wins in France, then you're going to be back to, oh, my, that's it, the euro's finished, sell. Okay, and you're going to see another wave coming back into the dollar. So it's not always domestic issues. The gold bulls, they're preaching the wrong story for so long. They confuse themselves. Gold does not go up with inflation. It does not go up with an increase in money supply. If you take the 1980 high in gold of 875, adjusted for inflation, it's about $2,300. We didn't even exceed that. What makes gold go up? Really a hedge against government. When it went up into 1980 because there was a complete lack of confidence in Carter. All right, that's when gold goes up. Gold rises during any period of a crisis in confidence. Gold has been rising, okay, with the three rate increases. All right. It has risen with the dollar. Why? Because basically it's a hedge. You have to look at it from everybody's viewpoint around the globe.
Yeah, but what about what just happened in India? I mean, you saw a gold spike when Maduro, you know, pulled the two currencies out of circulation, decided to go digital. It was actually into over 3,000 temporarily on gold. Isn't that an indication that maybe the system is broken, the currency system?
Sure it is. I mean, the whole system has a shelf life. It's not necessarily that the currency is evil or something like that. It's just, it doesn't matter what you use for currency. I mean, it could be paper, it could be conch shells, whatever. I think Milton Friedman said it best. If you put the government in charge of the Sahara Desert, there would be a shortage of sand within 3 years. The gold standard failed. All right, Bretton Woods collapse. Fix the price of gold, but you did not fix the quantity of dollars. So a 2-year-old with a pocket cup, ultimately is going to collapse. All right? We're in the ERM, the same thing. They tried fixing the currencies again. It collapsed. You can't do this. Now, our problem is not the currency. The problem is the management of government. If you swap out the dollar and say, okay, fine, we're going to create a new currency and we're going to call it quit or whatever, it doesn't matter. Because unless you change the source of the problem, which is government, forget it. And you can make it gold. You can make it anything. But you can't fix stuff and then leave it completely unregulated to the standpoint that government is irresponsible. That's when gold rises, is when people finally realize that the government is in trouble. It didn't really rise outside of India, all right, because we weren't ready for the U.S. or Europe just simply to cancel the currency, as they did over there. But ultimately, the currency system is going to collapse. I don't think you'll see it. But how does it collapse? It doesn't collapse with the dollar going down. It can only collapse with the dollar going up. The dollar goes down, as these people keep saying, then what's going to happen? Trump's going to win. Trade will be fantastic. U.S. will be selling everything out overseas, be very competitive, and corporate profits are going to rise. What will make it crack? What makes it crack is the dollar going up. Now you have all these emerging markets that have $7 trillion in foreign debt denominated in dollars.
The dollar keeps going up. Of course, rates have to go up with it. We have, what, $1.5 quadrillion in notional unsecured interest rate sensitive derivatives around the world. They start to blow up. The whole thing goes belly up.
What did the Fed do between 1927 to 1929? They doubled the interest rate and the stock market doubled. Why? Because they were trying to stop the rally. The more they raised the interest rates, the more the dollar went up. The more the foreign capital came. The same mistake. They've raised interest rates they will continue to raise interest rates. And if you look closely at the comments for this last rate hike, it was because the stock market went up. If the stock market goes up 20% more and the Fed doesn't raise rates, what's going to happen? They go down the Capitol Hill. Every Democrat's going to be saying, see, you're making the rich richer, and you're allowing them to make a lot of money, blah, 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 blah. Fed will be absolutely chewed out. It has to raise rates. Otherwise, it's not going to be seen to be trying to stop the stock market rally.
Take a look at the Zimbabwe disaster. I mean, you saw the stock market go absolutely ballistic with the precious metals as the currency was burned to the ground. But you're not expecting that. You really do feel the greenback will be maybe the least sick patient in the ward.
What happens is, first the capital has to come. This is why Roosevelt confiscated gold, okay? First, all the European countries basically went belly up on their debt. Britain went into a moratorium, but that all started in 1931. And if you want to read about it, you can go online and you can read 1931 Herbert Hoover's memoirs. You can look at that chapter. What he said is the capital acted like a loose cannon on the deck of a ship in the middle of a hurricane, shooting off in every which direction so fast, he said, we couldn't form a committee quick enough to even figure out what happened. That foreign capital basically comes here. As your government is collapsing, you then move the money over here. This is how the U.S. ended up with 76% of the world gold reserves. We were bankrupt in 1896. J.P. Morgan had to lend the government $100 million in gold. How did we end up with 76% of the entire world reserves? It's because after World War I, World War II, and all the 1931 sovereign debt defaults, everybody moved their money here. The dollar became Bretton Woods. Dollar became the reserve currency of the world. It came here because of that. We're enacting the same crisis. Japan's in trouble. China's got problems. Europe's got problems. Southeast Asia, they got their own debt problem. So the capital comes here. That forces the dollar up. In the Great Depression, our politicians didn't understand it. They went to protectionism. Then when FDR came in, they called him the farmer economist because he was out of the box. He's the one that said, listen, if you have to devalue the currency's too high. So he's the one that basically convinced FDR, against his own brain trust, the only way out of this was to devalue the dollar. Because the dollar became so high in value internationally, the U.S. couldn't sell anything. So the same thing will happen. The dollar will go up, which is exactly against what Trump was trying to stop. As the dollar goes up, that is what will then force entire monetary reset. It was the dollar going up into 1985 when the pound went to 103. That created G5 and the Plaza Accord. It was only the dollar going up that started it. And then at the Plaza Accord is when they suggested that Europe combine and create the euro to compete with the dollar. You're not going to get the monetary reset if the dollar goes down.
You know, we've got a lot of gold aficionados. Can you paint a scenario that ends well for the gold bulls?
Well, sure. I mean, eventually gold goes up when people begin to realize what I'm talking about. Fine, you have a lot of gold bulls that are talking all the time, oh, it's fiat, it's whatever. That doesn't get past them, okay? Just go to Starbucks and stand in line, and you'll see the bulk of the young people are just paying with their cell phone. Quarter, it's really worth $5. What you have to do is you have to get beyond that nonsense. And what gets it beyond that point is when the confidence in government begins to fail. Then all tangible assets begin to rise, okay? And it won't be just gold. You take the German hyperinflation. Now, how did it end? They issued a new currency in 1925, and it was backed by real estate. It really has to do with something with confidence more than anything. And gold will take off not because the stock market declines. Two of them will probably move together. And if they're moving together, what does it reflect? It's reflecting people are panicking outside the United States and bringing the money here. So stocks will be going up. Eventually, you'll see, you know, gold go up because each person in each different currency will be using it as a hedge against their own government. That's what makes a bull market.
Do you see a point where people just panic? They panic out of anything financial. They panic out of paper, and they search for that tangible safety?
Sure. We're just not at that level yet. If you look at the Gallup poll, 2016, retail participation in the stock market reached record lows. Average person isn't rushing back in there. This is not like 2007. Invest in stocks, take a dart, and throw it at the board, and you'll become a millionaire by next year. That is reflective of the end of the cycle. We're not even into that. That's why you don't see these big corrections people keep talking about. How are you going to get a big correction without the retail population in there? Not going to happen. You know, we're at that threshold where people have to basically see what's going to happen. And, I mean, all this negative stuff against Trump all the time, what are they really doing? Trying to prevent any reform. That's what they're really trying to do. And, I mean, they'll throw everything, you know, just like Christians. You know, you end up with a lot of nonsense that's being put out, but really what it's about is to try and stop reform. And what are they trying to stop reform? I mean, I think Trump is fantastic. He said, okay, fine, I want term limits. How's he going to do that? I agree with him. However, you know, is Congress all going to say, oh, yes, we are the problem, I vote for you, and we all have to leave within 2 years? No. It's not going to happen. Our problem is that we have career politicians that are there for 30, 40 years, you know, and they're disconnected and they're no longer really the people. I was at a dinner years ago when it was a New Orleans Specter, who was actually the guy that came up with the magic bullet theory on the JFK assassination. He was talking about Saddam Hussein back then and saying that, he's been there for like 35 years. I turned to Arlen and I said, well, how long have you been in the Senate? I think the confidence level, if you look at it, yes, to some degree, it was what you call the Trump rally. A lot of people had a lot more confidence that he was actually going to change things. But I think the reality as we move forward, going to find it much more difficult to try and actually change a lot of things. He might get the tax reform through, but a lot of the other things is going to be very difficult. And I don't think he's going to be able to put in term limits.
If you had to put a forecast on U.S. equities, do you see the Dow as much as doubling or even higher from these levels and a blow-off top?
Sure. I mean, I think the Dow has got nowhere to go but up. I mean, short-term, you have to have the corrections, but honestly, the corrections have been buying opportunities, and a lot of the foreigners, if you look at it in currencies, they are the ones that come in and buying the dip. The same thing as took place in Tokyo. The Nikkei was going up, it was all the foreigners buying. And then finally, you convinced domestic Japanese that, oh, I guess it is going up. And then they came in and they bought the high. But that's typically the way it is. And in fact, I was giving a lecture in Tokyo, and there's one guy bribed the hotel to sneak in. And he came up to me and he said, listen, I really apologize, you know, but I had to talk to you. What it was, I found it fascinating. Invested $50 million in the stock market, the first time he ever bought, and it was the day of the high. What was really fascinating was the first time he ever bought stock in his entire life. And I asked him, I said, what made you do it? And he said, the stockbroker called him every year for 7 years straight and saying, look, every January the stock market goes up 3 to 5% with the new year. And he watched it, and the seventh year he goes, you know, okay, fine, I'll try. So he bought December 31st. That's what I mean when you run out of buyers. You convince everybody who ever possibly thinking about buying is now in. It's over with that. We're nowhere close to that yet.
What's the one indicator or a couple of indicators that would convince you that we were approaching those highs? What would you be watching?
When everybody that goes on your show is bullish.
When the cover of Time magazine or one of the magazines is, you know, the perpetual bull in U.S. equities.
Something like that. I mean, basically you've got...
Uber driver tells you how he just made $1 million in a favorite stock pick.
That's pretty much. Look, Ferrari's the same thing. I was living in London at the time, and the pound went down to what to par. So a Ferrari, a 328 Ferrari, was about a $60,000 car at the time. Because it fell to par, the pound cost me like $30,000. I drove it around London for 2 years. Ferrari couldn't afford to sell it at that price, so then they raised the price to 45,000 pounds, I think it was. And then the pound goes back to $2. I drove it around for 2 years, and I sold it used, okay, for, I think it was 80,000. Many other people then thought Ferrari was a great investment, and these guys were going out buying Ferraris and stocking them in garages. I just looked at them and said, guys, I'm sorry, it's not the Ferrari. It was the currency move. That was it. So you have a lot of people, or you can probably still Google them. They have collections of Ferraris. They thought it was a great investment. It had nothing to do with the car.
You know, Doug Casey told us a similar tale a few years ago here on the show. He said, you know, if you play your cards right and you watch the currencies and the markets, you can actually live in a place scot-free and sell your home and then move on to the next place and live free there as well.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's currency changes everything, particularly when you're getting into moves of 30-40%. That's a big move. You had the euro up at 160, okay? So you come basically all the way down to 103. If you bought U.S. equity and you were a European in euro, you made a fortune, and the stock market didn't even have to budge.
A lot of our guests find a correlation between, you know, national debt, $20 trillion, and the potential for a bull to reemerge in the precious metals. Do you see any correlation there?
You have to look at this from a global standpoint. Yeah, $20 trillion sounds like a lot, but the global number for actual government debt is more in the 150 trillion area. We also have the biggest economy. And one of the lower tax rates. So the pure level of debt in the United States is not really the issue. You have to really look at it from a global perspective, and this is why the euro has failed. I met with the commission at the very beginning and how to structure this. I told them they had to consolidate all the debts of all member states and create a federal debt to compete with the dollar. They said, no, they can't do that because then it would look like it was a bailout for Greece or Italy or whatever. And I said, well, you're going to end up doing it at the end. And they said, we just want to get the currency through first, then we'll worry about the debt set. They never consolidated the debt. Why is that important? I'm an institutional trader. I got, a few hundred billion dollars. I can pick up the phone and say, okay, fine, buy me $50 billion of U.S. debt. Fine, done. Okay. Can I do that in Europe? No. Yes, we have $20 trillion, but it's $20 trillion that people can park in. You can't park it anywhere else. You can't go to China. You can't go to Russia. In Europe, you have to look at every individual country, and then you got different credit ratings. U.S., that $20 trillion is what makes the dollar. It's a place to park money. So I'm not concerned about the debt level so much. It's more of the incompetence of government in trying to manage that. The debt, I think, will eventually blow up, but, it's more or less from everything else. And it's because the government is the biggest borrower. So you can't be the biggest borrower and then use interest rates to try and affect the economy. Because you're affecting government more than you're affecting us.
For our listeners, as we wrap up here today, who maybe have some funds to add to their portfolios, can you give them an idea of where Martin Armstrong would park some of that cash? What looks good to you in the next 12 months?
Look at the stock market in three different flavors. The Dow is basically the big institutional international money. Think of it this way. When the Japanese came over here and bought real estate, what did they buy? Rockefeller Center. The Chinese, when they come over, what do they buy? The trophies. International money wants to buy the trophies. As long as the Dow is leading, it's showing you something. That's big money. Next is the S&P. S&P is the broader domestic institution. Some international goes into there, but not as much. Then you have the NASDAQ. The NASDAQ is the high-rolling retail market. Each one attracts a different flavor of investor. If you're looking for security and safety, basically you look more at the blue chip. One of the big pension funds just restructured based on what we told them to do. They got rid of all government debt and they moved to the blue chip corporate debt. And S&P went in and said, oh, gee, you're taking more and more risk. And they said, look, we ran the studies. We looked at what Armstrong said, and he's right. Blue chip companies don't default. Governments do. And when they do, you get nothing. You get haircuts, whatever, because they just passed the law and can do it. If a company went bankrupt, okay, fine. You get something back on the dollar because of all the liquidations of physical assets. You don't get that with a government debt. Government debt is unsecured. Can't go down to the National Gallery and start lifting Picasso.
So we keep an eye on the blue chips, they're Dow 30. We have then an idea where the foreign investment funds are flowing. If we start to see it lag, the Dow lag and maybe even the S&P, but the NASDAQ outperform, well, what do we take away from that?
Yes, when that starts to happen, now you're getting closer to the retail-type bubble you're talking about. They all have to switch positions. The Dow will start to actually go down first, and the other two will be rising. So you look for the differences like that. If you're looking at debt, stay short-term because interest rates are going up. But right now, it's okay in the United States with T-bills. I wouldn't worry about them so much. But going in after this year, you really don't want to really be in government debt so much. Certainly just keep it to the United States. What governments do, you saw India just cancel the currency, right? What they also have done historically, let's say you bought, 90-day paper. what do they do? Oh, we can't pay. We're converting it to 10-year paper. Italy did this. So you bought short-term paper, all of a sudden they converted to 10-year. And you didn't get your money back. You got to stay away from government debt because they're just not trustworthy.
You know, this is just the antithesis of what we learned in academia, isn't it? I mean, they tell us this is risk-free, the risk-free rate. They model it all into their big algorithms, Markov chains, and all the rest of the forecasting models and prediction, the genetic algorithms. And then, boom, Armstrong comes along and says, there's risk there.
There's a lot of risk there. And, you know, the Fed knows it. The Fed's concerned. I mean, I can tell you in the late 70s to early 80s, the Fed would call us first, and they would give everybody in the industry about a, you know, 15 to 30 minute warning. We're going to be raising rates today. Why? It wasn't insider trading. Most of the institutions were not really, you know, trading proprietary. What they were trying to do was to make sure that people didn't get hurt so much. Today, they call that, oh, that would be insider trading because you have banks trading proprietary, et cetera, from the 90s on. So what do they do now? They try to choreograph it. Looks like we're going to be raised. They try to tell you in advance. They're trying to still do the same thing, but they're doing it publicly. Rates are going up. There's just no question about that. And the Fed will be forced to raise rates simply because of the stock. Capital comes here. They're going to be browbeaten unless they do.
And you're looking for a government default. I mean, we haven't had anything like that since what?
Oh, the 1840s was state debt went belly up, not federal. And the last federal government to go bust was 1931. Domestically, that was the when Andrew Jackson shut down the Bank of the United States. That was then what happened was, then the money went to state banks, and then you got the wildcat banking period. I mean, you can go online and buy. Every bank issued their own currency. You had no idea if the bank was real, not real. You couldn't tell. Came to a head in the panic of 1837 and the 1840s. I mean, even the Bank of England still has, you know, bonds from Pennsylvania, from I think Georgia, which were never honored. You know, the 1930s was basically federal debt outside the United States. Most of Europe defaulted, South America for about the third time, and China defaulted. And you can buy those bonds on eBay. Make very nice things to hang up if you like.
And the tipping point for our next federal default, my guess is rates just get out of hand?
Pretty much. You also have to pay attention to the breakup of the EU. Merkel is probably not going to win. And you're looking at other countries pulling out. I think Greece probably will end up pulling out of the EU. Now you have all their back debt in euro that's going to have to be converted to a new currency. You know, so you're looking at really disturbing a third of the world economy. We have to watch everything. Basically have direct lines, sources that we were one of the first ones to say that Russia even went into Ukraine, right? Actually posted on our site. We had one of our people over there went up to a Russian soldier and said, oh, thank you so much. You're here to help us. Can I take a picture with you? And he did. So I posted the picture. I just cut her out. Sorry, Russian soldiers are in Ukraine. We have people everywhere. What has happened over the years is everybody realizes that our computer system is real, so being like, you want information from me, what are you contributing? We have people around the world that are contributing all the time from just about every government around.
ArmstrongEconomics.com. We appreciate your thoughts today. Great stuff, and hopefully talk again in 2017.
Thanks a lot for inviting me. Goodbye.
The gold and silver mining sector is red hot. Every investment portfolio needs precious metal shares. GoldSeek.com's top stock analysts have done it again, identifying the next solid gold nugget opportunity, Brazil Resources. Based in the eighth largest economy with a mining-friendly reputation, almost 10 million ounces of gold reserves, industry insiders are accumulating shares of Brazil Resources. The notable management team includes Chairman Amir Adnani, a rising star in the mining industry with a reputation for moving projects rapidly into production. Fortune magazine lists Chairman Adnani in the prestigious list of 40 under 40 ones to watch. Plus, shareholders benefit from the insights and backing of enigmatic Brazilian billionaire Mario Garneiro, CEO of Brazil Invest Group, the nation's foremost merchant and investment bank, and founding director. Their São Jorge project is 100% owned with paved highway access, a nearby workforce, and a hydroelectric power source near the major gold deposits. Their next top project includes three deposits identified by major gold producers, plus their RIA project, which is a joint venture with Areva, benefits from a $10 million treasure map in the hottest address for uranium production in Canada. But the story gets even more exciting with their Whistler project, offering geographic diversification in South Central Alaska. To find out more about this unique opportunity, please direct your web browsers to BrazilResources.com. At Yahoo Finance, ticker symbol BRI.V. Remember, to ride the exciting gold stock run of 2016 and beyond, your portfolio will thank you for adding shares of Brazil Resources.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
David Morgan pens the Morgan Report, covers economic news, overall financial issues on the global economy. Welcome back, David Morgan.
Well, thank you, Chris. It's great to be with you. And I guess we should state before we go any further that we're both having a bit of audio issues. I was criticized on one of my more recent issues about, David, clean up the audio, and we just do the best we can. You're in a remote location. I'm in a remote location. And sometimes we can't do any better than we're doing. So I think that's important to get out in front before we start the interview. Thank you, Chris.
Thanks for that, David. We are going to do our best to clean up the audio today, but you're right. Just moved to a location with very poor phone reception. 2017 is shaping up to be one of the better years for the precious metals in the last six or so. We just didn't have the follow through that you like to see with a nascent bull market. A lot of folks in the sector seem convinced that we could be building a base with this increased volatility to retest the former zeniths circa 2011. What are your thoughts?
When a market comes off a bottom, and it was a tough forming bottom for both metals, every time that is taking place, it becomes more of a trader's market. So in 2016, we emphasized in the Morgan Report for everybody to get on board for a rally in January and February. But like Richard Russell, I'm more inclined to let the market tell me what's happening than me to tell the market what it should do. So the market kept going higher and higher and higher. And then on the premium service, I do these updates on an as-required basis. And the commitment of traders is at the highest level it ever been. I said, that's enough. And I got everybody out of the trading position because we both invest and trade for those that want to follow my trade. And we got out basically at the top of the market in the summer of 2016 and watched it decline over the next several months into the end of the year. And this year, I basically said reload in January. And many people early on, as you remember, Chris, said it's going to be a repeat of 2016. It's going to go up, 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 up into the summer, and then maybe it'll fall back. Well, that's not what's happened. It's been more volatile. So right now, I think it behooves people to part of their positions, not all. Most people are better off with a buy and hold philosophy as long as they buy, you know, relatively low and have some patience. But for those that are more aggressive, it feels good psychologically and material in your pocketbook, in your bank account, your silver stack, if you are able to trade part of your position. So right now, I'm going to be doing an update for the members on the commitment of traders. It's been different in gold than silver because it's divergent. So you have a certain pattern set up in the silver market that doesn't necessarily carry over in the gold market. But I am convinced that the bottom is in. The bottom took place at the end of 2015. There are some out there that I won't name that are convincing people that the bottom is yet to be seen. is that the rally of 2016 was a bear trap, and that we're going to hit a new low in the intermediate term, meaning, you know, not the ultimate low we saw in the early 2000s, a lower low than what we saw when we touched around the $14 level in silver than the $10.50 level in gold. Lower than those lows, I doubt it.
You know, I think it's very responsible for a market watcher and commentator analyst to show both sides of the story. We see something similar here. I think, again, you know, it's just responsible to point out that a consolidation can break out either way. A lot of good signs like we saw. I like to compare it to the 2008-2009 sideways action in U.S. equities before the 8-year bull run. And maybe even more like, you know, 2010-2011 in the housing market as we found a bottom following one of the biggest declines in its history. Silver has held up really well on most of these sharp sell-offs. That tends to be another contrarian or positive development.
Well, I'm very inclined to use the gold-silver ratio, and I won't say on the radio because, you know, I'm paid for my analysis, but actually, Chris, from my perspective, we broke a level that gives me confidence that we're going up. It's more inclined to go down. These are based on probabilities. I mean, you know, do I have a crystal ball? No. Am I psychic? No. But I have 40 years in the market, and I get kind of in tune with the market. Doesn't mean I'm right all the time, but I also know what to do if I'm off. You know, I'm very, very explicit. So if the market does a certain thing, that gives me a confidence of the probability that I will continue in a certain direction. The amount of time, that's another factor. Those are usually educated guesses. So right now, based on the gold-silver ratio, I'm not happy with silver's performance relative to it leading in a bold way. So I'm more inclined to see more consolidation. I'll be doing an update for the, you know, for my members here later this week. Commitment traders improved somewhat in silver, substantially in gold on the left commitment traders report. So I'll go through that with them and, you know, highlight and circle and talk about it and all that stuff. I don't want to get everyone into the idea that, you know, I analyze commitment traders, you know, before their very eyes each and every week. And I don't. I do it. Well, maybe once or twice a month maximum. I do other things during the month because it is an important tool and it does give us good confidence, but it's not that accurate as far as timing, and it's not the only tool out there. It used to be back in the early 2000s. Basically, you could run all your trade off of the traders and do very well. But since the advent of the SLV and everything else that's come on board in ETF world and the other banking institutions and high frequency trading and quant studies on what the words mean. I mean, it just goes on and on and on down with this. What I'll put in quotation marks is AI. I'm not sure about what artificial intelligence really means, but what I do know is that these expert systems certainly are trading at rapid rates, well beyond what any, you know, human is capable of. So we're in a different world. But it doesn't mean you can't still, you know, use a pencil or paper and volume and figure out most of the time with like an 80% accuracy which way the market's going to go. On the intermediate term, I want to make sure if anyone signs up, not thinking that, you know, David has a day, you know, the trade of the day. I usually position trade two, maybe once. Last year it was one time. I got in January and got out in July. That was it. But it was a real nice trip from, you know, that $14-$15 level all the way up to the 19 level. So, you know, if you do that on leverage or even with the mining shares, I mean, a lot of shares, a lot of my people said, David, I'm not going to worry about it. You're seeing it's probably going to be about a 30% pullback. You know, I can handle it. That's fine. I'm buying hold and thank you very much. And then, you know, a few months went by and it's like, oh my goodness, I wish I would have sold some. You were right, blah, 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 blah. And I'm not trying to make myself right all the time. I've got too many critics out there, you know, all the time, and that's fine. They can criticize all they want.
First of all, I'd like to say 40 years in these markets. Look back at your trading career 10 years ago. So I wanted to first give you a hat tip for that. Secondly, I like this idea you bring up about virtual AI, artificial intelligence, expert systems, and of course, black box systems. It's a different world than we saw, 20 years ago. You mentioned the COT. I like to watch it as well. Like yourself, I view it as really almost a fundamental indicator now to give you that longer-term confidence that you're on the right side of the trade. But even more importantly, back to AI, you talked about there are still pockets of profitability, I think, might be one term. And I think that that really is the trend. It's the theme. It's the market bias that scientists refer to as autocorrelation and serial correlation in the markets. I think that that's where the Morgan Report, GoldSeek, GoldSeek Radio, and other services add value to our listeners' portfolios, can help keep you on the right side, keep your confidence level hopefully high. When volatility increases, you still need to be on the right side of that trade. I think I hear a more upbeat silver investor today. Is that a fair assessment?
Well, you know, I've tried to be consistent, and I, for most people, the best thing it could possibly do is buy some physical silver, physical gold and silver if they're of that capacity. In other words, their net worth is high enough and they have that much, you know, savings, and put it away and forget it. You know, I think that serves most people the best. You know, just go about their lives, financial crisis, collapse or not, they're protected from a monetary aspect. There's a lot more to a collapse scenario than just money. So that's, you know, for free and for fun, and just, again, just relax about it. Something should make you sleep better at night, not worse. For those that are in the silver stacking community on up, that take this market more seriously and have more invested both in time, effort, and energy, that's a different scenario. So for those people, obviously, you know, we have our free stuff that we do with, you know, interviews like this. And I write something weekly at themorganreport.com free letter. And then, of course, we have our premium membership and our mastermind membership. So, you know, it depends on what the person really needs. But I think most people are just best served by having a position and paying for it in full, putting it in their hand, and forgetting about it, really. I mean, not forgetting about it like they don't know they have it. They just relax. And as far as am I more upbeat, I think I'm more upbeat because I think people are coming around, and the more people that understand the truth, the better off we'll all be. I mean, I was down in the Anarchapoco conference with Jeff Berwick, the dollar vigilante, recently, and it was like a 4 or 5 day event. I only stayed there for a few days, had to come back and write the report, but it's interesting to me, and what I said at the end of my speech, and it holds true, is there's nothing more powerful than the truth. And if we all start speaking the truth, you know, to everyone, everywhere, we would have a much different planet than we have now.
Isn't it a Matrix-like moment, David Morgan? I mean, you talk about the truth. It is essential, especially in the investing arena. Of course, truth needs to be disseminated in a responsible manner. We don't want to force people to take the red pill, right? But our very survival may hinge on whether we choose the right hand, let's just say. I think that's where, again, your service and hopefully ours can really benefit folks. Why don't you leave a tasty tidbit, cuisine for cogitation, with our listeners today as we wrap up this interview? My guess is you have some interesting insights on what type of show we might see ahead in the precious metals sector in 2017.
Well, Chris, you know, I sent you a press release regarding this. It's a precious metal technology. It's a inert reagent that basically precipitates metal out of the solution. And it's going to be something, what, of a game changer. At least it's my initial impression. I'm trying to hold back my enthusiasm, but it's a long story. My members know about it. I sent it out on the blog, so a lot of people are at least familiar with part of the story. And this is something that could be monumental. I mean, this is going to be a big close, a long close. But if you go back to the silver guru of the last bull market, which was Jerome Smith. Jerome Smith wrote Silver Prophets in the 70s, which some say was instrumental in getting the Hunt brothers interested in the silver market. He wrote Silver Prophets in the 80s, a subsequent book to his first one, What's Behind the New Boom in Silver, The Coming Currency Crisis, and several other books regarding, basically founded on Austrian economics. And he had predicted $200 silver by like the mid-90s. And the last book he wrote was published in the early 80s, 83, 84, somewhere in that range. And what he missed, and he was a smart guy, what he missed was a technology change. What he missed was heat-leach cyanide precipitation gold. And that sounds like a very basic thing because it's been around for so long. However, at the time, so if you looked at the data that he used, he never got more than about 350 million ounces of fine silver out of those earth in any given year, going back decades, actually going back centuries. So he made the assumption, an incorrect one, that 360 was the top level of silver you could produce out of the earth. When Heath leaching came along, it changed the technology and the amount of silver produced went up and up and up and up. So I am very careful to always bear that in mind because it's important that, you know, there are technological changes throughout all sectors. This one will probably have more effect on gathering recycled silver and gold than it will the mining industry, although it plays a part in each. But it's actually more beneficial from a monetary aspect. In other words, it's more lucrative to harvest computer motherboards, cell phones, these RAM fingers, and everything else.
That's really an opportunity for investors today because with the price so suppressed, gold and silver well below fair value, at least according to most of our top guests, there really aren't the economic incentives to recycle. You probably won't see the impact or effect of this technology until prices have moved sharply higher. I think it might prove invaluable to certain miners. So that would be something to keep an eye on if they increase their productivity. Please tell people more about the Morgan Report, all the great stuff they'll have, and why they need to bookmark that site.
Yeah, just get on our free e-letter. It's once a week at least, and it's themorganreport.com. Just give me a first name and a valid email address. It's a double opt-in. I still want a few because we want, you know, serious people even for our free work. And you'll get an email saying validate that you are you. You click that link, and now you're in, and you will get a welcome letter, and you will be in the fold, which means that every time I do an interview like this, on the weekend, we'll send it to you so you can kind of pick and choose or listen to them all or leave commentary or whatever you wish to do. And that's it. So that's it. And of course, if you want to upgrade to a full paid membership, we always appreciate that as well, of course.
David Morgan, look forward to hearing further comments ahead in 2017.
Good, Chris. Thank you.
The gold and silver mining sector is red hot. Every investment portfolio needs precious metal shares. GoldSeek.com's top stock analysts have done it again, identifying the next solid gold nugget opportunity, Brazil Resources. Based in the eighth largest economy with a mining-friendly reputation, almost 10 million ounces of gold reserves. Industry insiders are accumulating shares of Brazil Resources. The notable management team includes Chairman Amir Adnani, a rising star in the mining industry with a reputation for moving projects rapidly into production. Fortune magazine lists Chairman Adnani in the prestigious list of 40 under 40 ones to watch. Plus, shareholders benefit from the insights and backing of enigmatic Brazilian billionaire Mario Garneiro, CEO of Brazil Invest Group, the nation's foremost merchant and investment bank, and founding director. Their São Jorge project is 100% owned with paved highway access, a nearby workforce, and a hydroelectric power source near the major gold deposits. Their next top project includes three deposits identified by major gold producers, plus their RIA project, which is a joint venture with Areva, benefits from a $10 million treasure map in the hottest address for uranium production in Canada. But the story gets even more exciting with their Whistler project, offering geographic diversification in South Central Alaska. To find out more about this unique opportunity, please direct your web browsers to BrazilResources.com. At Yahoo Finance, ticker symbol BRI.V. Remember, to ride the exciting gold stock run of 2016 and beyond, your portfolio will thank you for adding shares of Brazil Resources.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
This is Robert Ian with GoldSeek.com Radio. A bright spot emerged this week amidst the intellectual paralysis that has developed as reporters recycle and regurgitate more often than usual, a narrow band of stories trying to force a particular narrative on everything from healthcare to spies to lies. Monitoring mainstream media and the independent, what I call direct media, for cohesive insights under these circumstances can be a daunting task when narratives become focused into repetitive feedback loops. I've often said that a confused mind does nothing. And just in case you hadn't caught on, the purpose of said confusion is to stall change, stall innovation, and preserve a political status quo. When this kind of chaos and confusion reigns supreme, bright spots, when they emerge, need to be pointed out. One of those bright spots was the announcement by the White House of what will be called the White House Office of American Innovation, the OAI. The purpose of this office is to make recommendations to the president on policies and plans that improve government operations and services, improve the quality of life for Americans now and in the future, and spur job creation. These recommendations will be developed in collaboration with career staff, along with private sector and other external thought leaders. A cross-section of reports on the Office of Innovation indicate they plan to reimagine how efficiencies can be created. It appears measurable results will be a key component of what they are seeking. The OAI has an initial focus on technology and data, and is reported to be working with Apple Chief Executive Tim Cook, Microsoft founder Bill Gates, Salesforce Chief Executive Mark Benioff, and Tesla founder and Chief Executive Elon Musk. The office has already hosted sessions with more than 100 such leaders and government officials. One description of the office is that of an offensive team, an aggressive non-ideological ideas factory, capable of attracting top talent from both inside and outside of government, and serving as a conduit with the business, philanthropic, and academic communities. Significant downsizing is expected to occur across the government, with proposed cuts in many departments. The OAI has indicated they will help find efficiencies. Innovation and change concepts have been implemented and integrated by business on a widespread scale for over two decades. Initially, new ways of doing things can often be met with resistance. And to implement innovation and change into the federal government with an effective, action-oriented approach will no doubt be met with significant resistance. That resistance will take the form of many distractions that are becoming painfully obvious as we watch the actions and inaction of countless elected officials, and behind the scenes, non-elected officials as they scramble to maintain relevance and power against the backdrop of change that will occur with or without their permission. Those who resist change will be consumed by it. And when massive changes and innovations are implemented, they are often perceived as threats. The innovation and change is perceived as criticism, which is often unwelcome. But constructive criticism or change should always be shared with suggestions that will help solve the problem. There will no doubt be changes and innovations we agree with, and those we don't. But the key aspect of this process is the mindset and accountability that goes into aligning and redirecting the forces of innovation into solution-based outcomes. This kind of accountability comes with growing pains, and because this is national politics, will come with a lot of rhetoric attached. I like the concept of the Office of American Innovation. Bringing innovation and change management principles to the practice of government at the highest levels is long overdue. The creation of a non-ideological ideas factory is essential for governmental change. For this to work, it will be necessary to ignore the rhetoric and focus on the results. And until next time, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com, reminding you to follow us on Twitter at ConquerChange. Thanks, Chris.
Okay, Robert, thanks for another excellent installment. Well, that wraps up this week's GoldSeek.com radio episode. For two new big guests, be sure to check out next week's show. Until we talk to you again, have a great week. The gold and silver mining sector is red hot. Every investment portfolio needs precious metal shares. GoldSeek.com's top stock analysts have done it again, identifying the next solid gold nugget opportunity. Brazil Resources, based in the eighth largest economy with a mining-friendly reputation, almost 10 million ounces of gold reserves. Industry insiders are accumulating shares of Brazil Resources. The notable management team includes Chairman Amir Adnani, a rising star in the mining industry with a reputation for moving projects rapidly into production. Fortune magazine lists Chairman Adnani in the prestigious list of 40 under 40 ones to watch. Plus, shareholders benefit from the insights and backing of enigmatic Brazilian billionaire Mario Garneiro, CEO of Brazil Invest Group, the nation's foremost merchant and investment bank. And founding director, their São Jorge project is 100% owned with paved highway access, a nearby workforce, and a hydroelectric power source near the major gold deposits. Their next top project includes three deposits identified by major gold producers, plus their Ria project, which is a joint venture with Areva, benefits from a $10 million treasure map in the hottest address for uranium production in Canada. But the story gets even more exciting with their Whistler project, offering geographic diversification in South Central Alaska. To find out more about this unique opportunity, please direct your web browsers to BrazilResources.com. At Yahoo Finance, ticker symbol BRI.V. Remember to ride the exciting gold stock run of 2016 and beyond. Your portfolio will thank you for adding shares of Brazil Resources.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice. GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.